Right now it's working.
Okay, welcome everybody. Next week is Rabbi. Next week is Ari Mermelstein, then Rabbi Kalbus, then Rabbi Rubin, then Rabbi Adler, and then Rabbi Sittner. Rabbi Sittner davens in the Beth Abraham area, and he was a rabbi in Charlotte. Charleston and has a lot more accolades than that, but that's a couple of weeks ago. Next week is Ari Mermelstein. Once again, it gives me a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Gottlieb. He took a little absence; he was a little under the weather, but Baruch Hashem, he is doing great. Baruch Hashem, and we welcome him back to our circuit. Each and every time that I ask him, he is willing and happy to give of his insights in Torah. So without further ado, Rabbi Gottlieb.
Thank you so much, Howie, and thank you all for coming this evening, for braving the weather, which is a little iffy, a little unpleasant, but it is great to see everybody. So some of you may know that for the past 8 summers, I have spent a good deal of time, at least 2 weeks, in this particular summer it was more like 4 weeks, in New Haven, Connecticut, where I'm involved in a program for high school students under the auspices of the Tikva Fund, and we study at Yale University. New Haven is a complicated place, if people that know New Haven. You have this jarring dichotomy between the beauty and glamour and majesty of the university campus and the squalor and the sadness of the city of New Haven. But I spend most of my time on campus, and I have a little ritual. When I go to a city that I'm not familiar with, I always try to seek out the bookstores. And of course, New Haven is a fun place in terms of bookstores, as you might expect with a university of the stature of Yale. So this summer, one of our programs was housed in something called the Greenberg Center. It's a beautiful facility. It's often the site of Yale University conferences. It's attached to this beautiful Victorian-style home that housed dignitaries and other statesmen. Right adjacent to the Greenberg Center is the Yale Divinity School. And so I found myself one day during one of the breaks walking, kind of meandering around the campus, and I found my way to the entrance of the Yale Divinity School. And to my great joy, there was a large, relatively large bookstore in the Yale Divinity School. And they had a display of all the titles that were written by Yale faculty. So it looked interesting, and I picked up this little book here by John J. Collins. John Collins, I actually knew who John Collins was. He was a professor at the Div School at University of Chicago when I was a graduate student back in the 90s. So, you know, I'm dating myself, but I'm dating John Collins a little bit more because he was a professor back then. But now he's the Holmes Professor of Old Testament Criticism and Interpretation at Yale Divinity School. And he really is considered a specialist in the Hebrew Bible. He's a bit of an Ohev Yisrael, to boot, someone who loves Judaism and loves the Jews. And this book looked really fascinating. It's called What Are Biblical Values? What the Bible Says About Key Ethical Issues. It sounded like a very interesting book, and so I'm going to just quote the opening section. What are biblical values? Talk of biblical values is ubiquitous in American political discourse. An advertisement in the Wall Street Journal by the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, published in the run-up to the presidential election in 2012, provides a typical example. In it, the popular preacher calls on his readers to vote for candidates who affirm biblical principles and support the nation of Israel. It's good to know. He continues, I urge you to vote for those who protect the sanctity of life and support the biblical definition of marriage between a man and a woman. Not surprising from Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. Collins goes on to say, his commentary, that values are principles that offer guidance for human conduct rather than specific laws or commandments. So, for example, we might think of love of God and one's neighbor or the pursuit of holiness as broad values that might be espoused in a variety of ways. In practice, however, biblical values, and you could put like scare quotes on that, biblical values are often boiled down, as they are in the Wall Street Journal advertisement, to specific positions on a few hot-button issues, most frequently the rejection of homosexuality and abortion and the affirmation of traditional family values. Notice the sheer, our sheer tonight's biblical family values and the evolution of monogamy. These positions stand as symbols for a way of life. They are seldom accompanied by any serious reflection on what the Bible actually says about them. Rather, people who accord high symbolic value to the Bible tend to assume that it conforms to their own traditional views. If they read the Bible with any care, they might be surprised by what they find. So Collins sort of suggestively telegraphs his own position here, is that in that what people assume to be biblical values or biblical family values more specifically are often more complicated than that, and that you might be surprised to find what the Bible really says. So the issue of polygamy is in 2019 not exactly a hot button issue, unless of course you're from Utah or you watch Big Love or Sister Wives or one of these television programs that kind of sensationalize the idea of multiple wives. Some of you even know what I'm talking about, which I'm very pleased. I wasn't sure if those pop culture references would, not you, Howie. I know, you're slaving away as a pediatrician, helping lives, and you don't have time for that, gosh, Mias. But there is one reference, one slim reference in this book on page 89 to polygamy. And you'll see why, and maybe some of you even have anticipated why polygamy is the topic tonight, given its Parshas Ki Tetzeh, but we'll save that for a moment or two. But this is the sole solitary line in this whole big book, 200 plus pages, about polygamy. So what does he say? He says, polygamy was accepted down to the common era, although it is rarely attested in the post-exilic era, roughly after 500 BCE. So I think I want to apply Collins' own position or Collins' own claim that you might be surprised if you dig deep in the Bible or certainly in the Jewish tradition broadly. He really tries to limit his discussions to the Hebrew Bible and to the New Testament. But I think if you took the topic of polygamy and you actually scrutinize it and interrogate it, you'd actually find some more complexity. Now, on the surface, it should be straightforward that polygamy is permitted in the Torah, right? In the Hebrew Bible, polygamy is permitted, right? Obviously, right? Give me some examples. Why is it so obvious? Okay, well, Yaakov, and not only Yaakov, but Abraham. What about this Parsha?
Likes the one who likes less.
Okay, excellent. So open your Chumashim here to page 1046, the very beginning of Parshas Ki Tetzeh. Jan is absolutely correct, and this is really what jogged my mind, or what made me think about polygamy in the context of the shiur, when Howie asked me to give the shiur on Parshas Ki Tetzeh. It's the opening verses, that the opening sections that are very noteworthy, because there are three opening parshiot in terms of actual units in the Torah. The first unit that opens up this week's parsha is what? Very famous category, very famous concept. The Eshes Yifas Toar, right? The woman who is taken as a captive in war. And Rashi famously says here, Dibra Torah Ela Keneged Yetzer Hara, that this permission to take an Eshes Yifas Toar is basically a concession to human nature. It's not an ideal. It's not something to be valorized or romanticized, but it's a concession to human nature, to the weakness of human nature, especially to the weakness of human nature in war, maybe to male human nature, to male desire. But it's certainly a concession. And what follows in the order of parshiot after Yifas Toar is the case that Jan identified, Ki tiena leish shtei nashim. If a man has two wives, ha'achat ahuva va'achat snua. One is loved and one is hated. This could be just hyperbolic. It could be one is favored over the other. It doesn't have to be, doesn't literally have to mean that one is hated, but one is favored. And what happens? Behold, the child is born, the eldest child, the bechor, is born to the snua, to the woman that is hated or less liked. And the natural predisposition or the natural propensity would be to favor the child of the loved wife, of the woman that you love most. So the Torah says, no. The Torah says, you cannot do that. You cannot favor the wife that is beloved. You have to give the pishnayim, the double portion of the bechor, to the woman's child who is really technically firstborn, even if she is the snua, even if she is hated. That's the second parsha. What's the third section of Parshas Ki Teitzei? Another very famous halacha case. The Ben Sorer, or the rebellious son. Chazal have a lot to say on this. Maybe lo haya v'lo nivra, it never existed in terms of practical, executable law, both literally and figuratively. But it's on the books. And here, and this is really the genesis of tonight's shiur, a Rashi. The Rashi that I actually shared with you a few moments ago, saying that the whole concept of Eishes Yifas Torah is a concession to human nature, to the weakness of human nature in war. Rashi then goes on to say, "In ein Hakadosh Baruch Hu matira yisaena biisur," that had God not permitted the Eishes Yifas Torah, there's a good likelihood that the man in battle would have taken her as a concubine or as a wife in a state of forbiddenness, in a state of illicitness. Aval imnasa, but if he indeed takes her, if he takes the Eishes Yifas Torah, what will happen? Sofo lios son'a. Eventually she will be hated. Eventually this man will come to his senses and he will hate himself for taking this captive, this Gentile captive, and this woman that was taken as the Eishes Yifas Torah will become the Eishes Snua. Rashi is suggesting that the order of the parshas is no coincidence. That there's a smichus of parshas, there's a juxtaposition that's very deliberate, that's very purposeful, and it's to teach you this very phenomena, this very dynamic, that you should not take the Eishes Yifas Torah, because that's really beneath you. It's wrong to take a captive of war. That's not a Jewish ideal. We permit it as a concession to human nature, Dibur Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara. But if you do take her, you should know that there's a very good chance that you will come to hate her. And he says it, he takes it one step further. What do you think he says? It becomes the Ben Sorer Mor. The child that comes from this hated woman that was the Yifas Torah will become the Ben Sorer Mor that has to be put to death as a rebellious child. Well, thinking about this Rashi, and this is a Rashi based on the Sifri, so it's already based on a Sifri and a Tanchuma. These are based on not the earliest strata of Jewish oral law, but later, the Sifri is one of the earliest strata, the Tanchuma is later. What is this Rashi on a subtext or a subterranean level teaching us? Is polygamy an ideal? No. Polygamy is not an ideal. When is polygamy formally prohibited? Anyone remember from Jewish history? From the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom. So the 11th century, Rabbeinu Gershom, Maor HaGola, the beacon of the exile, formally prohibits polygamy. Simultaneously in the Ashkenaz world, we'll see later that it's not accepted by the entire Jewish community, but it was accepted by the Ashkenaz Jewish community. There's a sister takana, there's a sister decree that Rabbeinu Gershom enacts at the same time that he enacts the prohibition on polygamy. Not to divorce your wife, bal korcha. Not to divorce a wife against her will. Technically, by biblical law, it says, because of la sefer krisus, v'shalach la, that you could just simply give a bill of divorce, a writ of divorce. But Rabbeinu Gershom, already in the time of Chazal, it was frowned upon to give a divorce against the will of the wife. And Rabbeinu Gershom nullifies that. Now, what's the connection between the ban on polygamy and this prohibition of giving a get bal korcha against a wife's will? Women's feelings, more than women's feelings. Think about it. Think about it from a legal point of view, or from a practical point of view.
Agency.
Well, how would a man, if a man wasn't happy with his wife, he could just give her a get. But if Rabbi Gershon prohibits that, and at the same time he prohibits having multiple wives while you're still married, Rabbi Gershon effectively protects the agency and the safety of women in a way that dramatically alters what the communal practice, or one could argue that the communal practice was already at this point and Rabbeinu Gershom codifies it or makes it formalizes it, but that these developments were already in motion. And what I want to argue tonight, and what I think the real crux of tonight's shiur and talk, is that already in Tanakh, but certainly in the times of Chazal, we see evidence of a mitigation of the permission of polygamy and a slowly evolving attempt to make monogamy the Jewish ideal. Question?
Meaning later in this parsha, the fact that you can't divorce a woman and then
marry her again.
It's also the bad thing.
Right, it certainly does limit, because then if you marry someone else, then there can't be someone in between. You can't bring back your wife. Right, and there are, just as I've suggested, that this juxtaposition based on the Rashi and the Tanhuma that already is telling us what are the consequences of polygamy, what are the negative consequences of polygamy. Of course, you just read Sefer Bereishis carefully and you see the negative consequences of polygamy. But now it becomes, you know, over the breadth of the time of Tanakh and Chazal to Rabbeinu Gershom, we're going to see this movement or this evolution, what Rav Nachum Rabinovich, the great living Rosh Yeshiva of Male Adumin Birkat Moshe, who wrote a monumental set of commentaries on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah called Yad Pshuta, Rav Nachum Rabinovich in a 1988 article called Darka Shel Torah, very important article. You can get an English translation of this article online. But in 1988, he wrote this massive article, and one of the sections of the article deals with what he calls the development of halakha to reflect the values of Judaism. That the values of Judaism, that polygamy, slave, he gives the two examples of polygamy and slavery, that these were institutions that were permissible in the time of the Tanakh. The Tanakh is full of laws around slavery, and we see laws around polygamy, but that it was never an ideal, and he brings some proof, and we're going to look at some proof tonight. It was never an ideal, and that over time, when the Jewish people became more reflective, more civilized, more mature morally, then the law actually reflected that reality and codified and authorized those values in the Jewish tradition. But that even from the beginning of these institutions, there were always limitations and always, in some sense, some hard ones, some softer ones, but there was always a sense of what the Jewish ideal was, and that the evolution of halakha is codifying over time this ideal. Now, this is a radical idea in some ways. It could strike some people as too revolutionary or too progressive, because he believes that there is a progression, but it's a progression that he argues is already embedded in the Torah itself. It's already found in the first places that you find slavery, or the first places where you find polygamy. As we've just seen now, in this case in point, this juxtaposition, the suggestiveness of this juxtaposition, certainly the way that the Tanhuma and the Sifrei read it, it's very much a way of weaning us off of polygamy, or weaning us off of slavery. Now we're going to see some sources that build on the ideal of monogamy. If polygamy is a legislated institution that's permissible at the time of Tanakh, but it's not ideal, what are the other models that are being presented that show us what the ideal of Torah marital relations are? What's the ideal of monogamy as we would call it today. Question, Becky?
Oh, it's crazy. I'm teaching this small island. Today we discussed Panina and Kana, and my students were very upset about this.
Right. Okay, great. It's so, Penina and Chana are actually one of the few cases in Tanakh that you could count less than 12 cases of actual polygamy in that are recorded.
They're struggling with is what it made them feel very negatively towards the avot,
right,
that they're doing this. So if that's if you can get it into your Shia or
Tanakh. I mean, I think it's actually part of what I've already touched on, in the sense that a concession to a historical reality or a concession to economic realities, what was the most important reason to have polygamy?
More children.
More children, right? And having children is a Jewish value. So there were multiple values that were clashing or that had to be reconciled, and polygamy as an institution was permissible for the time that it was, but it was never an ideal. I'm arguing that it was never an ideal, and we can talk more, but I think that's already, I think, a good step in the right direction by acknowledging that it was not an ideal. You should look at this article by Rabbi Rabinovich. I'm happy to share it with you, and where he builds an entire theory around this, a very fascinating theory. So let's begin with models of monogamy that actually suggest an ideal of husband and wife that is exclusive. And I think we're in the right month to do it, because it's Chodesh Elul, right? And Chodesh Elul always signifies Ani l'dodi v'dodi li, right? I am to my beloved as my beloved is to me, which is a beautifully exclusionary pasuk in terms of what that relationship is. It really does come to highlight the unique relationship between husband and wife. But if you think about it allegorically, the way that we understand Ani l'dodi v'dodi li, we understand it at the pshat level that it's referring to a husband and a wife, or two people in love. But we know that throughout Jewish history, it has also always signified the relationship between God and the people of Israel, right? Kadosh Baruch Hu and Knesset Yisrael. And here we have many examples in Tanakh where the relationship between God and the Jewish people is seen as not only the one of belovedness, even though it's a wayward relationship, the Bnei Yisrael often goes off the path, but it's almost always referred to as an exclusive one, as the only, that God has chosen only the Jewish people in this type of relationship. So let's look at just a few quick psukim in here in Yirmiyahu, very famous. Haloch v'karasa b'aznei Yerushalayim, go proclaim in the ears of Jerusalem, le'mor ko amar Hashem zachati lo chesed nurayich, avas klulosayich lechtich acharai b'midbar be'eretz lo zrua. Right? I recall the devotion of your youth, Bnei Yisrael, your love as a bride, your love as my wife, as my beloved, how you followed me in the wilderness, in a land not sown. So here, this idea of monogamy as an ideal, it's reinforced by this oft-repeated metaphor, this biblical metaphor of the Jewish people, Bnei Yisrael, Knesset Yisrael, as God's unfaithful, but still beloved, and ultimately the only spouse, the only wife, that God has. Look at the second pasuk. Ve'avor alayich ve'erech v'inei itech eis dodim ve'efros knafi alayich ve'achase ervoseich ve'eshava lach ve'avo be'rvis osach num Hashem v'tiyeli. That I spread my robe and covered your nakedness. It's this intimacy. It feels like something more exclusive. And we also get some references in Tanakh that indicate a definite preference for monogamy. In Mishlei here, Matzah Isha Matzah Tov, V'yafek Ritzon Me'Hashem, that one who found a wife, and it's in the sing, it's one wife, it's not multiple wives, it's one wife, you found something that is favored by God. Now, one could suggest that these are all, for the most part, these are allegories for the relationship between God and man, but we do believe that relationship, certainly the Rambam codifies this in Hilchos Tshuva and other places around, we should be aware of this as we, in Chodesh Elul, as we're close to the Yamim Narayin, that the model for the relationship between man and God is the model between a husband and wife. That Hilchos Tshuva, Rambam famously talks about the passion that one is lovesick for one's beloved the way that one should be lovesick for a Kaddish Baruch Hu. But if we wanted to get back to sort of the primeval or the primordial or the prototypical male-female relationship, one could do no better than look at the beginning of Bereishis. Right? If we look at the beginning of Bereishis, let's look on page 2 here. V'yibra Elohim es ha'adam etzalmo b'tzelem Elohim bara oso zachar unakeva bara osam. Man was created male and female. V'yivarech osam Elohim v'yomar lem Elohim pru urvu milut et ha'aretz v'kipshua. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and conquer it, urdu b'digas hayam, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over shamayim, and the birds of the sky, v'chol chaya romeses ala aretz. So what does this very well-known set of psukim do for the monogamy polygamy discussion? What does it put on the table here? We already touched on this a little earlier tonight. Because what's the purpose of polygamy? The main purpose of, there's an economic consideration, but it's for children, right? So the first thing that this pasuk or this unit of puruvu sets up, it sets the stage for the primary purpose of polygamy, which is to increase the viable number of children that every Jew has. But there's another direction here that's actually at tension with this, with the pru urvu element. What's that? What does this pasuk say?
One man, one woman.
Right? That's even highlighted in the next pasuk, Perek Beis, pasuk Chavdal. Al kein yazov ish es aviv es imo. Therefore, a man will leave his father and his mother. V'davak biishto v'hayu levasar echad. One flesh union, as it's known in the natural law debates about homosexuality and same-sex marriage and divorce, in some cases in the Catholic Church. But one flesh marriage. But at the very least, it's man and woman, one relationship, not multiple wives. What else here? What could you say then about this biblical, the Bereishis orientation to polygamy and monogamy? One could say, if we take it seriously, as Susan, you know, this one flesh union, that is the ideal. The Torah already in the book of Bereishis sets the paradigm, the ideal, this prototypical marriage between Adam and Chava, where there are no other people there anyway, but you know, however you understand that. But there was no, it's just one man, one woman. Husband and wife, that's the ideal. The Torah then introduces polygamy as a concession to human nature. Economic considerations, considerations of children, considerations of prestige. But the ideal already is set in the book of Bereishis. It's set at the very beginning of man, an ideal of monogamy, which then the concession to human nature, just like we saw by Eishes Sifas Torah, Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzahara. The Torah speaks to the evil inclination of man, and it gives something concession rather than prohibit it when people will go against it anyway. Certainly in the Near East, the culture for most of the instances that Bnei Yisrael were engaging with the outside culture was a culture of polygamy. Egypt wasn't such a culture of polygamy. Babylonia was a culture of polygamy. So it's your surrounding culture. How do you navigate between being a countercultural force, combating the outside culture, versus assimilating within just to live so that people can obey the Torah and not break the Torah? We get that too, though. We get the parent-child.
But I don't get why it has to be all romanticized. That can be from a different...
It's multiple. It's a great question. I think there are multiple metaphors that Torah and Tanakh and Jewish tradition use to describe this relationship that have different dimensions. That very purpose. When Maimonides talks about it in that almost eroticized way, it's very striking. One could say that it's striking in an uncomfortable way or in a dangerous way, but it could also be striking in a strikingly powerful way that doesn't have to have the prurient dimension. It doesn't have to have the illicit dimension. But it's a good question. Now, one could argue that these sources, the one flesh model, they're more agadic than halachic. because we're not learning a lot of halachot from a pru urvu that's established as a halacha. So then Chazal can say zachar unukeva baram. That's the machlokas, if you remember, between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, how many children you have to have. So one uses a proof text of zachar unukeva bara osam baram as one male, one female. But that's after there's a halachic sanction of pru urvu. Whereas this monogamy, polygamy question by Hayu Labasar Echad might sound more agadic and homiletic than strictly speaking legal or juridic or halachic. Okay, let's move now to this next page, the Mishnah in Sota, where there is a straightforward sanction of polygamy. So we're talking about cases, the Mishnah here in Sota, on Perek Dalet, Mishnah Gimel, is talking about cases where a woman is not able to give birth. So she's either an islandess, she doesn't have the simane nekeva, she doesn't have the female genital organs, or if she's a zakena, if she's past menopause, or if she's anaroi leilate, if she can't give birth for some other reason, a defect. So she doesn't ever drink the waters of sota. If she's accused of being a sota or an unfaithful wife, she does not drink the mei sota. And she also doesn't get the ksuba. But Rabbi Elezer says, Yochol hu lisa isha acheres, that if he's married to this woman, he could marry another woman. V'lifros v'lirbos heimana, and he could have children from another wife. So that's a case where, because the woman is not able to give birth, another woman could be married in the time of the Mishnah. The Mishnah sanctions it because of the mitzvah of pru urvu. Okay. Now here I present two fascinating, I would say, extra canonical documents that are not part of Tanakh and that are not, strictly speaking, part of the Jewish legal tradition, but they're both relevant to this question of polygamy and monogamy. The first is called the Elephantine document. Elephantine was an island in the Nile, near just south of Cairo. And in the year approximately 441 before the Common Era, so about 100 years after Churban Bais Rishon, there was a Jewish military garrison on this island in Egypt. So they've done archaeological studies, they've dug it up, and they found amongst the archaeological evidence of this military garrison, they found documents, marriage contracts, basically like ksubas. And they found in a number of them a document that says more or less the following: and I shall have no right to say I have another wife besides Mefitiha, and other children than the children whom Mefatiah shall bear to me. If I say I have children and wife other than Mefatiah and her children, I will pay to Mefatiah the sum of 20 Karashin, royal weight, and I shall have no right to take my weight, goods and chattels from Mefatiah. This is basically a Tanai, a contract with a condition that the man says, I'm not going to take another wife. So it's a monogamous relationship where the man legally obligates himself to honor his wife's wishes not to have another wife. So it's just an interesting legal phenomenon. This was already 441 before the Common Era, so just about 100 years after Churban Bais Rishon, the destruction of the first temple. And it's written in Aramaic, this document, and it's proof of already monogamy being part of the culture, at least in this military garrison. But the suggestion is it's more common and more widespread. Even more radically is this next document called the Damascus document. The Damascus document is one of the sectarian Essene, probably from the Essene sect, most of their materials are located in what we call the Dead Scroll archives, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And here it's even more extreme or absolute, that marrying a niece or getting a divorce or polygamy was all considered znus. That's how they call it. That's how this Essene sect calls it. They are caught by two snares, by unchastity, namely taking two wives in their lives. While the foundation of creation is male and female, he created them. See? They're quoting what we suggested as the source in Bereshis, male and female, he created them. And those, what other proofs? And those who entered Noah's ark went two by two in the ark. And of the prince it is written, let him not multiply wives for himself. Is this the king? This is the melech. We saw in last week's parsha, Parsha Shoftim, lo yarbit lo nashim. Now there the suggestion is that you don't increase, you don't multiply, but you're allowed to have more than one. But even there, the Gemara and the Mishnah talk about how many was allowed, how many was permissible really, what David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech exceeded. Fascinatingly, the Karaites may be drawing from this sectarian, you know, reading here from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Listen how they read. This is in Parshas Vayikra by the Parsha of Arayos. This I'm now reading. We're going to go back to Vayikra, Perek Yud Ches, Pasuk Yud Ches. It's on page. It's on page 653. So I'm going to read this pasuk, and you tell me how you think you could read it in a way that sheds light on this monogamy polygamy debate. The isha el achosa lo sikach litzror legalos ervasa aleh bechayeha, and a woman and el achosa. How would achosa would literally mean what?
Sister,
right? So that's where we get one of the prohibitions is to marry two sisters. That's the one that Yaakov. It was pre Matan Torah, so he didn't prohibit. He didn't transgress this prohibition. Notice also litzror, to cause harm. What is a co-wife called in Gemara?
Atzara.
Which is enough, maybe that's all you need to say about the shir. All you need to say is that in Torah, in Torah Shebaal Peh, what is a co-wife called? Tzara. Trouble. It's no good. Polygamy is no good. But how do you think the Karaites, who are very literalists in their reading of the Torah, how might they read this and defend monogamy? It's a very ingenious reading. Isha el achosa doesn't mean literally a sister. It means you're like your brother, your sister, other Jews. It means marrying a woman and another Jew, another woman, another female, another woman from the tribe. That's how they read it, as an absolute prohibition of polygamy, as an absolute requirement of monogamy already in Tanakh. Again, that doesn't stim with a lot of what we've seen in Tanakh, but at least it's a very creative way of reading this if your eye is towards monogamy. Okay. Let's now turn the page, Mishnah Bechoros. Another very telling Mishnah, Mitzvahs Yibum Kodemis L'Mitzvahs Chalitza. The mitzvah of Yibum, of a Levirate marriage when a man dies without a child, without an heir, so a brother, the brother has to take that wife, that widow, so that he can be Mekayim, the lineage of the brother, right? About Boaz and Rus, right? That's a case of Yibum, right? But listen to what the Mishnah says. Mitzvahs Yibum kodemis l'mitzvahs Chalitza. That ideally in the priority of things, Yibum comes before Chalitza. Yibum was the positive command to engage in the Levirate marriage. Chalitza was the out. Chalitza was the clause, the out clause, that you could do Chalitza and get out of the mitzvah of Yibum. So originally when the Tanakh was given and the law was promulgated, Yibum took precedent over Chalitza, Barishona, in the beginning. Shahayu miskavenin l'seim mitzvah, because they were doing it for the right reason, that when the brother married the widow, the ex, the sister-in-law, he did it l'shem mitzvah. V'achshav, but now, she'ein miskavnin l'shem mitzvah, now when their kavana is corrupted, they're not marrying for the right reasons, they're not doing this mitzvah of Yibum, then Amru, they say, mitzvah chalitza kodemis l'mitzvah Yibum. The mitzvah of chalitza of not going through with the marriage precedes, takes priority over the Yibum. No polygamy. You see that? This is a way of Chazal already limiting. If it's saying that the intentions once were okay and that people can do that mitzvah of Yibum appropriately, that was fine. But now they can't do the mitzvah with the right kavana. You have to do chalitza. You must do chalitza. Now you could say that's only because it's a sister or a brother, that it's one of the arayas. You're not allowed to marry your brother's wife. But I'm suggesting that it's not just a din in the actual yibum of the sister-in-law, but it's a generalized concept that they're trying to slowly militate against polygamy and slowly promulgate the priority of monogamy. And this Mishnah has a way of doing that by eliminating by eliminating Yibum, by saying Bizman Hazeh, we don't do Yibum anymore. We only do Chalitza.
Is that because at that point monogamy was the standard?
That could be, and right? And it's said to reflect that, or it could be that it's a way of kind of moving the bar, the needle forward, you know, so that people will start to realize that this is not no longer sanctioned. This is no longer good. Look at the Targum. Fascinating, talking about Boaz and Rus, maybe the most famous example of Yibum in Tanakh. So, do you remember what happens when Boaz goes to the Ploni Almoni, who is the one that really had the right to marry Rus or Naomi, and he declines? Do you remember roughly what he says? He says, "I'm sorry, I'm not really interested. It's a very short discussion. I'm not really interested. If I have a child, basically it'll hurt my estate. It'll hurt my, because my own kids will now suffer because now I have to support these other kids. I don't want that." And then you do it. So that's what Boaz does. Look what the Targum, though, says for what happens in this exchange between Ploni Almoni and Boaz. Read Pasuk Vav. V'amar parika ki hei gavna leis ana yochal lemifrigla. The Redeemer, this Ploni Almoni, says, "I cannot redeem her because I have al de'is li itza, because I have a wife. Leis li reshu lemisav ochara nisa Allah. I have no permission to marry another. If I marry another woman, I'll cause trouble in my house. My wife won't like it. It'll be bad for my house. Prok loch at, you marry her. You be miyabim her." He's saying it was forbidden. This is a targum to Megillas Rus. So it's a fascinating, another, no polygamy. We're eliminating polygamy. Okay. We're kind of running out of time, so I just want to look quickly at the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef, and the Ramah. Because by now we have Takanas Rabbeinu Gershom. The Shulchan Aruch is written 300 to 400 years after Takanas Rabbeinu Gershom. And look at how this is the first Siman and the first Sif, the very beginning of Eben HaEzer, the section of Shulchan Aruch that deals with marriage. Dine Piri Rivia, Vishol Lama Below Isha. The laws of be fruitful and multiply, and that one should not be without a wife. And there are Yud Dal Tse'ifim. There are 12 paragraphs. Chayev, this is now the Beis Yosef speaking. This is the Shulchan Aruch speaking. Chayev ko Odem Lisa Isha Kedei Lefros Vili Rabos. You're obligated, legally obligated to marry in order to have many children. V'chol Misha Eino Osek B'Piri Rivia, and whoever doesn't engage in Piri Rivia, Ki'ilu Shofich Damin. It's like you murdered. U'mayit Esa Demus V'gorim L'Shechina Shetisalik Misrael. That you decrease the Demus, the image of God in man, and you cause the Shechina to depart from Israel. That's the Beis Yosef. Does the Beis Yosef have Takanas Rabbeinu Gershom? No. Look with the Ramah. Hagah, this is now the Ramah, Rav Moshe Ishulis of Ashkenaz, of first Poland and Ashkenaz. V'chol misha ein lo isha, whoever doesn't have a wife, shori belo bracha, remains without blessing, below Torah, without Torah, below Nikra Adam, he's not even called a human being. The Kivin Shenasa Isha of Anosa Mefapkin, someone who marries a wife, his sins will depart. Shenemar Matza Isha Matza Tov V'yofek Ratzon Eis Hashem. That was the pasuk we saw from Mishlei. What does the Ramah say? How different? Look at the contrast in language between the Beis Yosef and the Ramah. The Beis Yosef is only speaking in what juridic language, legal language. You have to have Piri Rivia. If you don't have Piri Rivia, you're destroying the Shechina. You're making the Shechina depart. The Ramah is much more romantic, much more ideal here, that you need a wife. Oh, with a wife comes goodness, comes wonderful things. Takanas Rabbeinu Gershom, the sense that the ideal of monogamy has already been fully, you know, entrenched in the Jewish people in the lands of Ashkenaz, not so in the lands of Sfard. And the last thing here, the Eben Ezer, here, the last thing, that Nosa Adam Kama Nashim, this is Mechaber, the Beis Yosef saying a man can marry many wives, the Esher and the Makayim B'Sivi Kohen, as long as you can support them, you have to be able to financially support them. And then the Hagah, Rabbeinu Gershom hichrim al nosei es ishto aval b'yavama lo hichrim b'chein ba'arusa. That Rabbeinu Gershom decreed this, and it's all the lands cannot all the lands have accepted this? Rabbeinu Gershom, according to Beis Yosef, not so accepted. Until much later, in Sephardic communities, you still found that. But again, let's come back to Chodesh Elul. Ani l'dodi v'dodi li. What I want to suggest is that ideal, that model of the relationship between the Kadosh Baruch Hu and the Jewish people, that unique, monogamous, exclusive relationship, is the pattern for every husband and wife. And as Rabbi Rabinovich says, that was the ideal always from time immemorial in the Jewish people. But as a concession, we allowed polygamy, but slowly Chazal, already in the times of Tanakh, but certainly by the end of Chazal's time, we already eliminated the existence of polygamy altogether. We should go into the year in our relationships with our husbands and wives and our relationship with the Kaddish Baruch in that passionate devotion to monogamy, to the exclusivity of that relationship. Have a wonderful week. Good Shabbos.